It's All Things Considered, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, and I'm Dave Lawrence. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a very special guest. We had a great talk the other day on the phone with one of my favorite guitarists and certainly one of the most impressive guitarists of all time, Al DiMeola. He is here at the Blue Note, spending some time in Hawaii. First time in a couple decades, as I recall from our thing. Welcome, and thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Was it like 20 years? How long, if you can remember when you last played here? It's got to be a while.
Well, that I played actually in Honolulu has to be, 30 years.
30 years. Well, it's pretty cool. And I'm trying to cover some things that obviously we didn't cover before and use the other interview as a sort of springboard. And one thing I never got to, parli italiano. Do you speak Italian?
Si. Di parli?
Yeah.
Si?
Hey. And you speak it fluently?
No, not fluent.
But just a little bit. Tell me about the connection. Any connection to the, when did you first make the discoveries on a cultural side?
Oh, well, I grew up, in a very Italian tradition, in New Jersey, of course, but everything was all about food, and music, food and music and everything Italian,
Do you feel at home when you're there?
Proud of our heritage and like a lot of Italians in that area of New York, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, it's just so many. And it was mostly the Southern Italians that came over to the States. The poorer part of Italy was looking for a new life and a new world, And they were the ones that came through Ellis Island and migrated, not the Northerners, because the Northerners were more prosperous and more industrial, and you get very few from the North that actually came over until much later,
You feel any special connection when you get to play over there?
Oh, big time, because playing Napoli is the area, or we say in Italian, the vicino Napoli, the vicinity. Yes. Of you get the vibe that the people are, that the people have a connection, or I have a connection to the people of the area because of my we say genitori.
Yeah, parents.
Yeah. So,
I tuoi genitori, sono
the generations are all from the area, and on this trip, my wife made a very special connection to the hometown of my grandfather, which I've never been. In fact, I've never even met him.
What's the name of the town?
Cerreto Sanita, which is in the Campania region, and Campania region being like a county, And in that county is Napoli, which was an hour and a half away. And the biggest city next to Cerreto is Benevento. So it's kind of in a center in the south. And we went to this little village that my wife kind of organized with the town people. And I had no idea what to expect at all. But I thought it would be really cool to see where the DiMeolas came from, where my grandfather left to come to start his family in the United States. And we got this kind of hero's welcome with the whole village. It seemed like the whole village turned out. As we pulled up, they were like cheering like it was a parade or something. And police were like out there holding people back. And it was like Elvis pulled up or something. And I got the whole big, key to the city and, honorary citizen. And they all had all the town council people had to vote me in the courthouse. And it was like a big, for them, it was a really big deal. For me, I was beyond blown away, So they were very proud. They knew of my existence and my music for, 40 years. And I didn't know that they were
that aware,
proud of me. But we on that trip, we got to meet a lot of relatives because my grandfather had something like 13 brothers and sisters, and only two of them wound up going to the States. So now you have about 11 or 12 of them with a lot of children, and those children had children. And so there's DiMeolas, half the town of DiMeolas, so I got to meet them all,
Backstage must have been a zoo.
Well, it wasn't a show. It was just a day off,
It's more of a joke, but I can imagine because it's a real vibe there with all those cats.
Amazing. And then getting to see my grandfather's home, and they had everything documented, tremendously documented, like the Germans almost. Like, just here's where your grandfather lived. This is, you know, the door he left out of when he left to go to the United States. You know, it was kind of on the verge of very emotional and satisfying. It was one of those days, you know, that will live on. And
it's a very cool thing. And I was
made it happen. She's amazing.
So your wife made it happen?
Yeah. Yeah, Stephanie.
That's very cool. Well, God bless her. That's great that you have something like that in your life. When we were talking before, we kind of got sidetracked in it, but I mean, you really explained some things about your history that I didn't realize about the Country Pickers having this big influence on you in the development of your style. And then from what I've read, it was hearing Larry Coryell's music that shifted the direction. Is that accurate?
Oh, sure. I mean, he was the first one to combine elements of jazz into rock, or rock into jazz, and elements of country, too, because I had a little phase of liking country music and bluegrass. So, you know, he had all of these elements in his style, which really appealed to where I was wanting to go with the guitar.
And the picking technique, we talked about that. You tell the fantastic story of Les Paul. I can just see him down on the floor looking up at your hand, trying to figure out the picking technique. For people who are listening, who, like, in a layman sort of way, I'm not a guitar player, but I appreciate it. Other people do. Can you kind of try to describe what it is about your picking style that makes that very percussive kind of sound? There's something so unique. And is there anything you could put your finger on in a way that I might understand?
Well, I mean, I'm more of a percussive-minded or percussion percussion. I'm more of a percussion player than even guitar. I mean, I hear everything, you know, rhythmic and articulate, and that is, you know, the crux and the really the heart of everything that I play. It has to be very articulate and played where it's not like you have to strain to hear the part, you know. So if you really analyze, if you were to analyze it, you can actually hear it as a percussion, as a percussion would play it, or a drummer would play it, you know.
That's a good way of describing it. When you think about, I'm like watching you tonight, I was, something that never occurred to me when we were talking the other day, when I think about your sound in the lake, let's say the late 70s, and it could factor in today, bands like Rush, a rock band Rush. I was watching you tonight, and I said to the guy next to me, Antonio, the GM, the assistant manager, I was like, can you imagine 1978, like Al opening for Rush, what the crowd would have been? What an incredible double bill. Have you ever crossed paths with them?
No, I mean, no. They have, you know, 15, 20,000 people at a show. I have 300. I still can't understand it. I don't get it.
Which part of that don't you get?
I don't get it. I mean, I think if people liked Rush, they would...
Like you too.
Yeah, they would love this too. But it just, for some reason, it's never crossed over.
And you never... So back in that era, same sort of question. Did you play gigs where they were packaging you with any rock artists? Or
yeah, in the beginning, it worked beautifully. Like, we would do shows with Supertramp or Fleetwood Mac. Or, Jesus, who else did we do? Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Oh, wow. You know, in the very beginning, that was with Return to Forever. And then the beginning of my group career, I did shows co-billed with Weather Report, which makes more sense. Right. But to expand your audience, they were more creative back then, you know, agents. And they would put, you know, me with a rock act or a pop act or something. You know, or Kenny Loggins, I remember.
Oh, wow.
I remember we were on a bill with Santana, you know, and all of that made total sense, and it just also made your audience grow. But you never see that anymore.
No, you don't. That's a very Bill Graham kind of style of doing things, mixing it up like it. So you agree with me, the Rush would have been a great double bill.
Well, it would definitely be, it's something they need too.
Right, and their fans would really appreciate you.
Yeah. But you got a problem with the managers and the agents.
Right.
Those are where your problems lie, you know. The managers and the agents fighting over the money, you know.
No, it's true. And as you pointed out, the lack of creativity with the booking, it's way gone. It's not like the old days. That's incredible to imagine you with Kenny Loggins, who's a really big artist out here in Hawaii, too.
Yeah, a wonderful artist and you know, definitely a different audience. In fact, we've done some with the Doobie Brothers. You know, just it was too infrequent.
Right.
And so long ago.
Yeah, it would have helped grow your audience. And I guess I just think of
I still asked for, you know, I said, if I go out again, I tell my agent, I only want to go out with another name act. But we can never get it together. So I always wind up going out just us. So just us means we're just going to get the core audience, right. My core fans. And you never grow it.
And that was exactly why I mentioned that to you, because I could just imagine how much that if you hit the right audience like that, those people would be completely appreciative of what you're offering.
Yeah, I know, but
okay. No, well, don't let it frustrate you. You're doing great things, and you have this 40th anniversary tour for Elegant Gypsy. We got on to the song, and we were talking a little bit about Race with the Devil, and we didn't really talk about the song. We were just talking about the cover of it. So first, has anybody else besides that band, Riot, covered it and recorded it that you know of?
No, not that I know, but, you know, I know it had to have been played. The problem is when it gets to those fast runs, what happens is they can't play it.
Right.
So, you know, everyone knows Bono. Bono, dun, 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 dun. And everybody knows, oh my God, that's, you know, Race with Devil, you know. But when it gets to the hard lines is where you know, it comes out sloppy unless you have picking technique, you know, good picking technique. And it won't work for those guys that sweep. Because, you know, sweeping is picking a note and then hammering on the rest. That's very ineffective. That's where that whole thing you were talking about, the articulation and the punch of the notes, you don't get it when you sweep pick.
Right.
Sweep picking is when you just glaze over the strings and you're not actually using your right hand to play them. You're using the feedback of the amp to sustain the notes. So you get woo-loo. Okay, that could have been about 6 or 7 or 8 notes. But did you get...
Right.
You know,
together.
Yeah.
Right. Now that makes a... So this is the riff itself... When did you come up with something like that? I mean, we didn't get on that. Like, because I look at that as the ultimate example of the crossover of what you're talking about. You could play that song for any rock fans, and they're going to go, whoa.
I was a fan some of the jazz stuff, Miles Davis, Chick Corea, as I was of, before I joined Chick, that is, as I was of years before that Led Zeppelin, you know, and... we all love that, you know, E minor kind of, you know, thing, you know.
Minor chords, that the intense, the dramatic stuff.
You know, and having that rock sound with a bit more, you know, meat to the composition, let's say. And my compositional inspiration comes from playing with Return to Forever. It also comes from the Beatles, you know, because it's such a strong sense of, you know, harmonic structure. And beautiful melody. So I always looked at the electric guitar, I think differently than most people. I looked at it as a beautiful, expressive singing voice, you know, but also as a rhythmic instrument. And trying to combine all of those elements, you know. So my influences, I think, were great. You have the Beatles, and as I grew up, I went through different phases, eventually coming to, like, you know, the early Bitches Brew, Miles Davis thing, and then, you know, getting turned on to what John was doing, Mahavishnu, and then Weather Report, and then what Chick was doing, and I said, man, that's where my head is at, you know.
Well, that's quite a foundation. So that riff, you don't remember specifically when you came up with that mind-boggling riff?
I don't really actually remember that, but I had to have been living with my parents still, because I think right through... Casino. So my first three records, Landed in Midnight Sun, Elegant Gypsy, Casino, I was still living with my parents, so I wrote that music while I was upstairs in my bedroom.
That's a very Italian thing to do, though.
Yeah, well, it's great when you know your mother's cooking downstairs some pasta, and you have the security of two great parents down there, and I could just do my thing.
You mentioned the Beatles, All Your Life, incredible record, tribute record. If you haven't checked this out from Al, it's a great bridge into Al. Talking about bridges into Al, that's a different kind of bridge into Al. And you recorded it at a very special place. There's got to be some stories that come along with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, during one of the summer tours, probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, I think. And I was in a real bad time of my life because I was going through a divorce. But I was on a tour with my European musicians. So we had, holes in the tour. And they would get to go home, and I would just hang out in hotels waiting for the next gig to happen. So I had the idea for a long time to eventually attempt to record some Lennon McCartney pieces, utilizing my own kind of bag of tricks.
Right.
And it happened when I was in Prague, and I was at a low point. But I said, I need something that's going to deflect my attention away from a personal matter, and. You know, if you have a dream, because most of what we do starts with an idea and a dream, and to make it happen, you just have to kind of, do it, take your first step. So I thought of studios. I remember I was thinking, where can I find a studio in Prague or maybe Germany? And I was just thinking, and then immediately I said, whatever happened to Abbey Road? Is Abbey Road like just a tourist site? So I called a friend of mine in London. And he says, no, yeah, he checked it out for me. He says, no, they're operating. They're in, full operation, all three rooms. And I said, you're kidding me. Wow. I have like 4 or 5 days off. Do you think, you could check it out for me? So he calls me back. He says, Al, they got 1 day open. I said, you know what? Book it.
Wow.
Book it. I called my daughter, and I called one of my best friends from the States. I said, fly to London, I'll pay for everything. I'm flying from Prague, and we're gonna go to Abbey Road.
Wow.
And it was a mind blower.
And all that famous gear is still in there somewhere.
The floor is the same, right. The walls are the same. In fact, I recorded analog like they did, not 24 track, 8 track. And we compared it with Pro Tools. And
how many inches, is that still 2-inch tape?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was 2 inch. It could have been 1 inch, but still, you're dealing with, you try. So whenever I did the AB with 24 track analog and Pro Tools, you don't really hear much difference. It's negligible. So this difference was wow. No wonder the Beatles record sound huge. No wonder when John Lennon's voice comes out of that right speaker and it sounds so magnificent. Or the cellos coming out of the left, it's like, they sound like 20 times the size if you had recorded on Pro Tools. So, it was just a highly inspiring project. I felt like a kid going to Disney World for the first time. It was like that.
And you nailed it in a day.
Well, I nailed 3 pieces in a day, and then I thought, okay, because it's so wicked expensive, I'll go back to the States and finish it there. But man, we went into the best studios in New York. I would try it even in my own studio, and the sound was not close. And wasted a lot of time. I said, you know what? We set the bar so high with those first 3 songs, sound-wise, I got to go back.
Right.
So before I go back, I'm going to go, do something extremely different and rent a house out in the Hamptons. I've always wanted to go to the Hamptons. It was the summertime, and I need to just arrange a few more pieces. And I want to do this in seclusion. So it was like 2 or 3 days before Labor Day, and nothing was available. Well, what was available was like out of sight expensive. So there was this one tiny little ad at the bottom, and this guy said, I don't normally rent my house, but I'm going to do it this time, and I don't know who you are, but you sound like a nice guy. And so when he called back, he said, can I have a minute, please? Can you close the door, please? He goes to me, I don't know if you know this, but your next door neighbor is a famous pop artist. And I said, "Oh, well, that's great." She goes, "But I'll call you right back just to confirm everything." So when he calls back, I said, "Hey," I said, "do you mind telling me who would—" I thought it was Billy Joel or John Bon Jovi. He said it was Paul McCartney.
What are the chances of that? And my next question was going to be, you ever run into those cats?
The chance was winning that lottery of $700 million, which is probably one out of 6 trillion. That's what that was like.
You get to run into him at all?
I ran into him. I mean, I put it in the GPS, pulled right up. Bingo, he was right there at the edge of his driveway with a few people, his wife and some people. And I just flipped. It was like, oh my God. Because that was, you know, that was my bucket list wish.
So you got to spend, that was the one time you got to meet him?
I got to meet him and talk to him, very friendly. He had no bodyguards, he had no gate at his driveway, my driveway, we were almost touching one another. And it was a mind blower.
Did he know who you were?
I didn't really, I wasn't in the mood to say, "Hey, I'm Aldo Viola, the famous guitar player." You know, I kind of preferred if somebody introduced us. Otherwise, you know, when it happens to me and somebody's trying to tell me who they are, and I, you know, it's like
awkward.
It's weird a little bit. So, and then the next year, I rented the house again. He was there. We talked again a few times, and I had the record was done. So my wife, who's amazing, Stephanie, went over there with the CD because I was too embarrassed to go over. She goes, "Write him a nice little long letter." So we wrote a letter and we stuck it in the CD. We still don't know whether he got it.
Wow.
But, you know, I think he knows now who I am because somebody said, "Oh, yeah, the famous guitar player. I know, yeah. And so I heard through the grapevine that he knows, you know.
So would she just leave it over there at his house?
She went over. We saw him pull into the driveway and run into the house. So she said, that was my chance. So she ran over, and unfortunately, he didn't answer the door. Somebody that worked there answered the door.
Yeah, so still probably
somebody gave him. Yeah, come on. It's like me. I get tons of CDs. I can't listen to them.
Right.
I can't. I just don't have the time.
Well, somebody might have hipped him out that it was Al Di Meola giving it to him, and it's not just
I think so. At some point, but I don't know if you heard it yet, you know. However, his manager and his booking agent is the same person.
Yep.
And that person, his name is Barry Marshall, started in the business with me. Now he's McCartney's guy.
Yeah, now you told the great story of that, and that was the cat who booked the trio gig, and it was first going to be Leo Kottke, and then he was like, "What's your feeling about doing John instead?"
Doing what?
Remember, he was the guy who helped book the trio gig, right? And he was the one who brought you the first idea was going to be Paco, Leo, and yourself. And then he came into you and he called you and said, "What do you think about doing John instead?"
Instead of Leo, yeah. I said, well, if you get John, then it's possible this could be a monster.
So I don't want to eat up too much of your time because I know you got to go. And one question, you kind of, I guess through the McCartney, it opens the door to it. You've gotten to work with so many cats. I mean, Stevie Wonder, Carlos, jamming on stage with Jimmy Page, and Les Paul. Are there people, you know, because you're a very down-to-earth guy, and it's endearing because you're a fan. Is there people left that you're still like, "Man, I'd really like to, maybe I can meet his agent, maybe there's like a way I can work it out"?
Well, it was only McCartney and De Niro, you know.
You met Robert?
No. But you know, those were probably right at the top, you know, or Pacino or something. Like if I had met Pacino, De Niro, or McCartney, that would be like amazing. I'd be like
a little kid. But I mean, how about an artist? Anybody you still want to collaborate with? Anybody you still have that thing? I mean, this is a guy who's done it all.
No, I think McCartney would be the one because, you know, what he had meant to me as a kid.
Right.
That would be the one. I can't think of anyone else. That's not to say there's not a lot of great ones. There are. He's just so far above everyone else that, you know.
Oh, there's no question. He's a monster. Eddie Van Halen, you ever run into Eddie?
I've talked to him a bunch of times over the phone about doing something together. And he's a very nice guy. And, you know, this is when Van Halen was hot. So I'm talking like the 80s. In the 80s, I said, "Why don't we do a trio?" You know, this is after the acoustic trio, me and John Paco. But But, you know, I think guys like that who have a very distinctive style, great at what they do, are also extremely insecure. Like, he doesn't read. He's not going to be able to play probably one-tenth of what I play, because it's a limited kind of thing that he does. What he does is it's the bag of tricks that he does and everything. He does better than anybody else. But when it comes to very rhythmic and complex music, it ain't going to go down.
Still be a bitchin' trio to just see the three of you try to work.
Yeah, well, as for a promoter, it would be a dream come true.
Who would be the third cat we'd get for that?
Well, you know, there's famous names, and then there's guys with the ability to play. Now, when the first guitar trio got together, we were the only three guys that can do that. There wasn't another guy that had the technical ability of me, John, and Paco. Now, you could put Carlos Santana in there, and promoters would go absolutely nuts, and fans would sell even more tickets. But Carlos wouldn't be able to play any of that stuff. It's too hard. That's not to say he's not a great player or stylist in what he does. He is. But what we did is very difficult music, technically. And there's not a lot of players that came up to that technical level.
We're really blessed that we still have you, and you're a fantastic interview. You tell great stories. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you the other day, and I'm just blessed that you were willing to take some time on your opening night here in Honolulu to be my guest. And again, it's the great Al Di Meola, All Things Considered, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I hope this was not a hassle. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome, my brother.